This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. Welcome to A Life in Film.
I'm Elliot James Langridge. I'm an actor, writer, and apparently a podcaster. And I love film. This is the podcast that we ask our guests from in front and behind the camera, how did they get their foot in the door? What was the key to unlocking their success? What's their story?
Find Nowhere Man, Fridays at 11:30 on CB, Jebu Glaba. Find Nowhere Man. Okay, cut it. Find Nowhere Man on CJBN-TV, Fridays at 11:30 p.m.
He's a real actor's actor. I've been a fan of his work since the 90s thriller, Double Jeopardy. The movie, he says, changed his career. He's collaborated with the very best. You may know him from iRobot, Capote, Deja Vu, Star Trek, or perhaps playing John F. Kennedy opposite Kevin Costner in 13 Days. But most recently, he's led the hugely popular Netflix series, The Fall of the House of Usher, in which I was surprised to find out he was a last-minute replacement. He got the phone call on the Wednesday, and he was on set by Monday. It was just a small matter of cramming over 500 pages of script into his head. He told some wonderful stories about his career, and what it's like voicing the iconic Batman, and why you should never be drunk on set. Our guest today is actor Bruce Greenwood. It's a life and fail. 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 Woo!
That monkey was a dreamer.
Maestrestes monkeys.
Yes.
Good.
Oh my God.
Hey, man.
Hey, yeah. Man, how's it going? Okay.
Good. How you doing?
Yeah, very good. First of all, thanks for taking the time, man. Really appreciate it.
Happy to.
Just finished watching your latest Netflix series, The Fall of of Usher. What an amazing first of part, but also an amazing project. Yeah. I'm guessing, I want to talk about that a little bit later on once we've kind of spoken about your earlier career and everything else, but amazing, such a dark and twisted series. Really enjoyed it. But to go back and to talk about how it all began for you, like the very start, where was the kickoff for you in terms of knowing that you wanted to be a performer?
I sort of came about it in a sideways fashion. I was taking a heavy course load at uni, and I thought if I took an acting class, it would sort of just take a little bit of pressure off, because it seemed like, well, I mean, first of all, you can't be failed for being bad. You know, you just got to show up. And but it spoke to everything that I sort of instinctively knew that I loved without realizing that acting could help me access all that stuff. So storytelling and humor and language and music. And I fell in love with it just because I took a course to sort of see what it was about, you know?
So I've been looking at your credits, and it doesn't seem possible that you fitted in almost 150 credits. And I'm sure there's probably other ones that maybe aren't on IMDb, but
I know there's one credit that I have that I didn't do. So
I really,
so there might be only 149 there. There's a movie that I was supposed to do that never got made that somehow announced itself on IMDb, you know. But,
oh, okay. All right. Well, I'll
yeah, no,
take
I started when
salt,
I was
then.
Like, I guess when I was in university. So when I was probably 19, something like that. Mm. And I'm ancient now. So I've had lots of time to, you know, stack them up.
Well, I hear, I don't know if the rumors are true, but you were tempted to go into skiing, professional skiing. Is that true? Or is that a
Yeah,
horrible
that's a
IMDb
yeah. I mean,
rumor?
I had this illusion when I was a kid that I could make a living as a professional skier and maybe a poet, sort of
Good
supplement the
combo.
income with poetry. Yeah, which of course, needless to say, was a pipe dream. But I got pretty badly injured early on in my young skiing career and never really recovered to a competitive level after that. So, and I skied for a long time after that, and I did some freestyle for a while. But my knees finally said, "Yeah, you're done."
Are you not able to ski anymore then? Is something that you're kind
I
of
can't right
even.
now. I mean, the last time I went was maybe 5 years ago, and I could take like three runs on a three groomed runs, and my knee just was, blows up like a melon,
To be fair, the last time I went skiing, just because I had a big gap, and then I went maybe, say, 5 or 6 years later, I realized that going from being in your 20s to your 30s, even just skiing is like suddenly hard work. So, I mean, it is hard on the joints, it's hard on the knee, especially if you've already got an injury, I imagine. But in terms of your acting career and it kicking off and getting your first couple of little roles and things, did you always feel kind of comfortable in front of the camera? Is it something that's grown over the years? You've got more comfortable with it?
No, I was thinking about one of those questions that they sent me that you might ask about embarrassing moments, and I do have a more embarrassing moment than this, but that I'll share with you. But when I was first starting out, I could literally see my heart beating through my shirt.
Wow.
I mean, I was terribly nervous. I couldn't. I was so unrelaxed in front of the camera. It's a miracle I got another job. Yeah,
So
no,
do
I was. Jaw was tight and really tense, and dialogue was terrible. Delivery was bad.
Over the years, have you become more comfortable? I'm presuming yes. You seem pretty, relaxed in your roles these days.
Yeah, I am more relaxed. Because you realize at a certain point, if you're not relaxed, you're not delivering anything at all. You're delivering a plan as opposed to inviting something to happen.
And there's a couple of actually a couple of credits. I mean, I've followed your career and I'm a big fan of your work, but I was surprised by a couple of credits that I was not aware of early on. And forgive me if it was a small role, but I saw that you were in Rambo First Blood.
Yes, I
And
was. Yes, I
that's a real
was.
credit. It's a real credit.
Yes, it's a real credit. Yeah. Guardsman number four.
Amazing.
And I was an extra for several weeks, just marching around in the pissing rain. And it was so freezing. Well, they dressed all the extras in a penitentiary that had been decommissioned, that had no heat. And it was below freezing and at night and pissing rain during the day. So we'd come in and put our fatigues on, and they'd be frozen, hanging there frozen. And
It
we did
sounds
that for
like
a
quite a
few
job.
weeks, and then I managed to weasel my way into a non-speaking part where I got to cower behind a log and look terrified. But I put that on my resume when I came to LA as though it was something, and it's remained there ever since.
Going back to a time like that where you were doing these small roles, is it hard to believe now the career, the collective, like the credits that you've had? Is it surreal? Is it surreal to go back and think,
Honestly,
wow?
I don't really think of it that way. I ignore the fact that I'm this old, and I'm always looking ahead to the next thing and taking some enjoyment from the thing I just finished. But in terms of the long, like sort of sitting back and looking at the long line of stuff that stretches over the horizon that I've been involved in, I never think of it that way. I just don't. It's not something that ever occurs to me, really.
What were those individual experiences on each of those sets? Can you remember all those jobs? There's so many jobs on your CV. Can you go back and think, oh, yeah, I remember that day and we were having that for lunch, or
Oh,
can you?
sure. There's some stuff that sticks out, and other things you go, as I'll meet somebody, go, "Hey, we did a movie together." I go, "We did?" Of course, we have memories that linger and memories that evaporate. And
And as an actor, I'm an actor myself, and I know that the in-between jobs is kind of part of the hardest bit of the job. Do you have, well, I'm sure now you don't need to worry about the downtime. I'm sure there isn't any. But, you know, when you were starting out and you were an actor starting from the beginning, the moments where you weren't working and you were kind of waiting for the phone to ring and twiddling your thumbs, did you have a coping mechanism, something that would help you get through those times?
Yeah, I'm not a thumb twiddler. I never sat on the couch waiting for the phone to ring. So I'm always, like, you know, doing some kind of carpentry in the house, or painting, or building something, or you know, playing guitar and wishing I was better than I was yesterday, which is just, you know, I've played forever and I haven't really improved. And so I'm always busy. I mean, I generally wake up happy and with stuff, something to do, you know. I'm never, and I think I got that from my parents. They're still around, and they're never still. There's just not enough hours in the day for either of them.
Wow. And were your parents, were they an influence in going into the acting?
No. No, that was not something that they thought was a good idea.
Oh, really? But
no, my dad's an academic. He's a geophysicist, and you know, and my mom's very, really well educated also. And that was not something they thought was really feasible. But, you know, to their credit, they went, you know, you're going to do what you're going to do, you know.
Did you watch a lot of movies growing up, or was it really something that came when you were actually in the business?
No. I mean, I didn't, we weren't allowed to watch television. First of all, we were given half an hour a day, or we could stock up that 2.5 hours to watch on the weekend. So I would not watch TV during the week, and then I'd watch Wide World of Sports, and that was it. So there was no TV in the house except for those allotted 30 minutes a day, and you could you know, you could stockpile those.
Are you a film fan now, or do you find that, you know, you love the craft and you love to be on set but not so interested in watching movies, or do you have?
Yeah, when I have the time, yeah, I can I'll luxuriate in a series or a movie or whatever, but I don't have that. That's what makes it really difficult during voting season, when you really have to see everything if you're going to vote responsibly, right? It's you know, who has the time to invest 100 hours at least? Well, if you're going to vote, you got to do it. And it's
so many films.
Yeah. It's a lot of work watching all those, but you know.
But someone's got to do it, right? Someone's got to do
Someone's got to do it, mate. Yeah. No, so I do it if I can, you know, if I've got time.
With the breadth of things that you've done in your career, I'm trying to think now, there isn't really a kind of genre that you haven't dipped your toe in at some point.
I've been thrown out of, genre after genre.
Oh, really?
it's just staggering from one genre to the next in the hopes that there's another one around the corner.
But is there a stone that is unturned for you yet? Is there a perhaps a genre or a type of movie that you're like, well, I feel like I haven't done that yet and I'd like to do that?
Well, I'd love to do, you know, for a long time I want to do some kind of banana peel slapstick flatfoot comedy, but you know, it's hard to be funny on purpose. And which I've discovered that on sets, to my horror. But I'd love to do something funny. I just finished something that I'm hoping will be funny with Bette Midler and Susan Sarandon, I like to do funny. But you know, one of the thing I did recently, Usher, it was so well written and it was so fun to luxuriate in that language that I'm just looking for stuff that's, hoping for stuff that's well written, you know. Genre side.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, there's looking at the people that you've worked with as well, not only the actors but the talent behind the camera, the directors, the list of people is crazy. Where any of the people that you kind of, I'm trying to think now of the things that you've done, but in terms of working with, you know, Tony Scott, JJ Abrams, Steven Spielberg, all these people, like going onto a set with someone like that, and a lot of these people you work with, you know, into your career, you were experienced, everything else, but do you ever get nervous?
Well, still, yeah. I mean, you walk on a set with Steven for the first time and, You know, your antenna are really out. You're very alive as to what his process is, and all the heavyweights that he's worked with, and all the wonderful actors he's seen in tiny little moments in films he's made, that you just go, wow, this guy has witnessed a lot of great performance. Mm-hmm. And oh no, you know. So, but you can't. I mean, you can't. Obviously, you can't sort of linger on that, or you're in big trouble. So, but just watching how some of these directors like Steven work so efficiently and so calmly and so supportively, and same with Mike Flanagan and Mike Femignari, they're very, very well prepared and really have a plan, but they're so well prepared and they understand the material so deeply that if you have a plan, if you can't execute their plan, or you have something for whatever reason, or you have a different idea, they're equally ready to field what you're rolling to them, you know, and let it morph into something that maybe they hadn't anticipated or that you hadn't anticipated also. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I guess one of the things I found with the really great directors is that they're, to a person, virtually always open.
Mm-hmm. You know? And you can experiment, have fun, and mm-hmm. hopefully be relaxed.
And hopefully be relaxed and just be breathing. You know, that's a real thing. Like, if I feel as though a scene is choking somehow, or I'm choking in a scene, I'll literally check if I'm breathing, because that's the number one connection to you being available, right? Mm. And if my breathing isn't regular, then I'm not relaxed. Then it's a sign. It's a really clear physiological sign of not relaxed. Mm-hmm. And you'll occasionally see me in a movie go, that's just me in the middle of a scene going, you're there's a freeze going on.
Mm-hmm. I'll look out for that. I'll look out.
Yeah.
For that
when so, I next... yeah.
Well, that's great advice, yeah. I think, for actors, but is there something that, you know, that you would say to an actor coming into the industry, a piece of advice that you would give, anything that you would dare to say to someone that's sort of starting out?
Yeah, do it because you love it, and don't do it to get paid, because there are no guarantees. I mean, in terms of the practical ways of introducing yourself to the industry, I don't know. I'm an old guy who introduced himself to the industry when the times were very different, you know. Well, in an audition, I'd walk into a room and there were people there.
Yeah, right? Yeah, it's a rare thing.
I mean, I didn't see a filmed audition until I'd been in the business for 25 years.
Yeah, wow.
It was just walk into a room and you meet people, and there was a whole different skill set that you don't, that isn't really necessary anymore.
Mm-mm. It's kind of a shame in a way. You know, I love that connection of being in the room and getting to sort of know someone and having the chat beforehand, and that kind of puts you at ease, I think. So doing a take.
Yeah, people do it different ways. Like some people like to come in and, you know, shoot the breeze a little bit. You know, just kind of break the ice, let them know who you are, and other people just want to come in and do the work. And I guess you just take the cue from the people on the couch who are scowling at you, you know. But the thing you have to remember when you walk into an audition, although this doesn't apply anymore, I guess, because people don't walk into auditions, but everybody in the room wants the search to be over. Mm. Right? They want to find the person. Mm. And in my view, it's not necessarily that they want to find the nice guy who's also the person, the character. They want to find the character. Mm. And chances are you're going to be a decent person. So, and I used to go in and try and amuse and, you know, shoot the shit and, you know, all that. But I stopped doing that after a while and just went in and did the work, you know. Mm. And if they want to talk after, great. Because they're really there to see you do your thing. You can make them talk first, right? You can start the conversation and they have to endure it, waiting until you're going to do the thing that they've asked you to come in to do. Mm. It's so, I would say minimize the small talk, But is that, yeah, like you say, I mean, it doesn't apply anymore because we're all just putting ourselves on film, right?
Yeah, 100%. It's a very different process now, which, you know, occasionally you do get to go in and that's fun. But now it's almost more nerve-wracking because, you know, usually there's a big space in between the times where you go in and the rest of the tapes, and it's like, it almost puts more pressure on it, I think. But
what do you mean there's a big space? I'm not following you.
As in, sorry, if you say recently, I've been doing loads of tapes, and then you get called in for an audition, you're like, oh, I've got to go in. And, right, and it's right, kind of like suddenly you're like, oh, I haven't done this for what feels like months, and now I've got to do this thing that feels not as natural as just doing a tape. But I think something comes out when you're in the room. I think you kind of, you're pressured into a situation and it's different.
There's a performance energy that happens, right? And if you can find that performance energy, then link it to being relaxed, then awesome. And it's a different kind of performance energy when you got a friend reading the off camera and you're, you know, busy doing your thing against the best lighting, the best background you can find without making the background the star of the show, you know. I still struggle with that, putting myself on tape for like, where am I gonna put it in the house? Am I gonna make it look really good, or am I gonna make it look bland, or how do I make it look as though I don't care, but I really care? And, you know,
how do you not have a wall? Lit? Is there not a special wall that you use or you move around?
I don't do it against a wall. No, I got some depth. I get depth.
You have a vista behind you, some sort of.
I don't know. I don't have something that's gonna draw attention, but I have something that gives depth.
Find the perfect background.
Another friend of mine just sent me an audition she wanted me to look at. And she was really good, but there was a freaking curtain hanging behind her. And I just went, this is reeks of an audition.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
So that really threw me off. But, you know, what are you going to say? She'd already sent it in. So I said, you were great. You know?
Oh, I'm really intrigued now. So what kind of background do you go for? If you want.
Well, in my kitchen, from our dining room to our kitchen, there's a little pass through. So there's a little bit of wall behind me about shoulder level. And then above that is kind of a hole where it shows there's some depth. And late in the afternoon, it's lit in such a way that most of the year that there's little shafts of light in the background. So you sense the depth, but it's almost out of focus. And it just feels like the guy was sitting in his kitchen doing his thing.
Yeah. Nice. You know?
Not like I set up anything special, when in fact I have set up something really special.
You've actually got lights behind in different places, making sure that the light comes through.
Yeah, I've tried to use those, you know, the circle eyeball lights, you know, to make your eyes kick and stuff like that. But it's too much bother. You just wait for the right time of day, get a kick off the table, you know.
Also, when you go in and, you know, if you get to, you know, go in and actually meet them and they're like, well, you don't look anything like that perfectly lit person that we saw in your tape. you've got to be careful not to overlight.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, the last couple of times I put myself on tape and got the job, I didn't meet them till I was on the set.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I'm surprised that you even tape the amount of stuff that you've done. That blows my mind. It kind of gives me hope, but it also kind of gives me like, wow, that's amazing. You're still, you know, still doing that. And that's incredible. That I would just think people offer you jobs.
They do. I do get offered jobs, but I did a movie with Bradley Cooper, like Place Beyond the Pines. Right.
Oh, I love that film. Yeah.
Derek C. and Friends movie. And we were chatting about this and this was after The Hangover, and he'd said that I'd been in a movie that he'd really auditioned hard for, and I went, wow, you auditioned? He goes, well, I put myself on tape in my kitchen last week. I mean, I doubt that Bradley does that anymore, and that was 10 years ago probably, and I don't remember last time when I put myself on tape. It might have been 6 or 7 years ago. But that's not to say that I wouldn't do it in a heartbeat if somebody asked me to. And you know, if you want to try and prove it to somebody that you're going to be good in something, then give me the chance. I'll put myself on tape in a minute.
Fair play. And to go back to like the early part of your career, would you, I mean, some of the earlier roles and you know, obviously stepping stones, little parts, like the little bit in Rambo and things like that. Was there a moment where, you know, you got a role and you were suddenly like, oh, this is where I should be. I feel like I'm in the right place. This is a, you know, a role that kind of changed things for you a little bit.
Well, it's happened really sequentially. And every little step up feels like there's a little sense of that, you know, like even when I got St. Elsewhere, it was like, oh, okay. A steady gig where I can practice every day and I can go in and kind of get some muscles working. And then I guess really the Double Jeopardy was like one of those things where you go, okay, this is, it's popcorn, but it's successful and it's working. And then 13 Days was the thing that I, because the writing was so great, right? David Self wrote just a magnificent script and working with Costner. And that was sort of my first, after I did work with Tommy Lee Jones before that, but you know, that was one of my first times of sort of working with a bona fide star, you know,
feeling
what that vibe is like. And
playing a real person, obviously, in John F.
Kennedy. Yeah, I had the luxury of doing tons of research.
That must be nerve-wracking, though, going in and you know, not only a film of that level, but with Kevin Costner, but actually playing a real-life person that people are going to kind of scrutinize and look and be like... Mm.
Yeah, but you know, the way I think of it is you're never going to get it entirely. And particularly with Kennedy, lots of people played him, and it's almost, I really think of it like I did a couple of colors in the kaleidoscope, and the other actors did a couple of colors in the kaleidoscope, and there has yet to be the definitive performance of that character, I think, because you can't get it all, and even this stuff, sometimes there you'll shoot stuff that doesn't make it into the movie that you think, this, I've got to do this little bit, this has got to be in the movie because it provides context to everything else I'm doing. And so, you know, like there was a Pulaski Day speech in 13 Days where, because his oratorial voice was quite high in pitch, but his speaking voice was really low. So I took great care during that speech to do it at his performance pitch, but it didn't make the movie. So you never got to see that I knew the difference, you know. But we, you know, we all throw stuff at the wall and hope that it makes it, and some of it does, some of it doesn't.
You've been cast as a president quite a few times as well. Not only
I have been. Yeah,
yeah. It's your speciality almost. I mean,
that's what I've done that more than anything else, I think. Yeah.
Have you ever played? I've never. I don't know if you ever played an Englishman in a film.
I have. Yeah, a couple of times. Ah. I did in Being Julia. I did
an accent
what else? I've never done like that at all. I've never done one of those.
Oh, maybe that's what's up next.
I hope so. It'd be brilliant, wouldn't it? Love it. Oh yeah, no, I did a movie called The Rehearsal, which I think was barely ever released, but I played an Englishman in that, and that was you'd have to be the judge to see if I got away with it, but.
I want to ask, you did mention...
But it. I do have a funny bit here. Is a funny little English story about...
Yeah, go on.
So I was doing a movie in London, and I went in to buy a guitar cord in that street that has all those guitar shops on it.
Oh, yeah. In Soho, was it?
No, is it Soho? No, it's not in Soho. Anyways, a bunch of shops. I was talking to this guy, and I wasn't doing anything very heavy at all. I was just talking like that. And for about, I don't know, 5-6 minutes, we were talking about guitars, and, you know, I asked for a cord, and I bought a cord and walked out. And as I was walking out, he goes, hey, mate, you might, do you want your receipt? And I go, no, it's all right. I'm all right. He goes, you might get back your VAT when you go home.
Oh, he caught you out.
And I just went, oh, fuck, I'm so busted. But, you know.
You've obviously practiced it since, because it's on point now.
Oh, is it? Okay,
yeah,
good.
It's very good.
But there's probably one, you know, it might have been on point, but I might have dropped. There might have been a bad
just
word.
One word.
One word where he goes, What's going on?
That's hilarious. Just to ask you, you did mention Double Jeopardy there, and I have to say, it's probably the film that introduced me to you. It's one of my favorite films from growing up. Absolutely love that film. Have you got any sort of stories of making that? Any sort of anecdotes that you can tell?
That I can tell?
That you can tell the public.
Yeah, there's some stories. There's some stories, but we'd have to turn off the camera because there's a couple good stories. But there's also some great, I mean, Beresford, who became a really good friend, and I've done a couple other movies with him. He'd never look at the monitor. I don't even know if there was a monitor. He would sit by the dolly with earphones in and binoculars. And he's literally like 10 feet away from you, right? And he's always quite surprised with everything he says. Sounds quite surprised. He's always talking like that. And I said, what's the deal with you sitting on the dolly? And, you know, and he goes, well, I can hear you perfectly. I'll see you quite close. I'm in the room. And it's true because you can feel him, you know. It's like you want to, if a director is at the monitor, yes, you want to please him or her. But if a director is right there
with the binoculars
with or without binoculars, you want to, you know, you're in it together.
Yeah.
Right. And there's a certain kind of performancy audience thing that, because the crew is, except in a comedy, a crew is, they're trained to be kind of invisible. Right. Mm. But a director is allowed to give you some kind of feedback. And so I really like it when directors are right there. Mm-hmm. And they used to always be there. Back in the old days, when there weren't monitors. You know.
Yeah, it's quite a detached thing, isn't it? I guess if they're in a, now you can, especially like during COVID, people would have been, if they were able to shoot, they would have been in another room somewhere.
It kind of changed things. I've had directors in, you know, in different rooms over loudspeakers. Yeah, we'll do it one more time. Back it up a little bit, you know. Really?
Is that usually on the bigger films, I'm guessing, or?
Yeah, it was a couple times on big films, yeah. But I mean, occasionally if there's action, so of course the director is going to be on a bullhorn. But.
Mm-hmm. Well, to go through some of your credits, I mean, Capote, obviously one of the best films of that year, 2005, incredible, Philip Seymour Hoffman. And working on movies like that, when you've done the work, and then, you know, a year or two later, the film comes out and it gets all this critical acclaim and awards and things like that. Can you enjoy that? Is that something that you enjoy, going to those sort of things? Or
it happens so seldom that I really enjoy it when it happens.
Mm.
Yeah, it doesn't happen all the time. So
every film. Yeah. I mean, there's been more than a handful of films where they've been very like just blown up, and obviously you mentioned Steven Spielberg, that The Post was obviously acclaimed to, I mean, the
and like the stuff I did with Adam McGuinn, you know, when we go to Venice and Berlin and London, and you know, that was when the festival circuit started, you know, when the awards thing started happening. And that was always, we do just, my wife and I just pinch ourselves, go, wow, we just landed in Venice for a film festival. That's amazing. You know,
living the life.
And it doesn't happen all the time. So you're really, it hasn't happened for a long time, actually. So
now for a quick break. Are you a writer and director, actor, costume designer, perhaps makeup artist? Are you interested in camera? This is the place to share your journey. We want to hear from you. How did you start your career? Has it started yet? And perhaps, if you're feeling brave, share with us your most embarrassing film-related moment. So slip into our DMs at Life and Film Pod on Instagram. Check out the Patreon at patreon.com/lifeandfilm, where you'll get episodes early and uncut, amongst other treats. And don't forget to follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you enjoy this episode, please leave us a positive rating. Add us on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, at Life in Film Pod, and find our video episodes on YouTube by searching Elliot James Langridge Life in Film. Essentially, please like and subscribe everything. It makes a huge difference. Thank you.
This podcast is sponsored by BetterHelp. Do you work in the film industry? Are you freelance? Or perhaps you have a 9-to-5? No matter what you do, mental health affects us all. I struggled early on in my career with the uncertainty of if and when I would ever work again, struggling to pay my bills, or simply with anxiety. Don't know about you, but being an actor, it's very important for me to maintain structure in the downtimes, and I found not only exercise, but talking to someone, for me, was a game changer. And so Life in Film has partnered with BetterHelp to provide you with access to the largest online therapy service in the world. And it can all be done from the comfort of your own home, from a phone, tablet, or laptop. No commute, cutting down travel costs, and most importantly, it's affordable. With over 1,000 therapists in the UK, BetterHelp can provide access to mental health professionals with a wide variety of expertise in mental health. If you need someone to talk to and you're thinking of giving therapy a go, BetterHelp is a great option. And being a listener of the podcast, you get 10% off. That's 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm. That's betterhelp.com/lifeandfilm.
And back to the show. I mean, there's obviously a huge part of your job, which is a lot of traveling and going all over the world. And do you enjoy going off and doing movies all over the place? Is that something you
love?
Because I hear that you're really into your sort of nature, skiing, golf, kind of things that obviously, if you get to do that all over the world, even better, I guess.
Yeah, generally when you're working, you know, I'm not playing around, right? I take a guitar everywhere with me, but and when the show is over, generally we'll take, depending on where it is, we'll take like 2 or 3 weeks if we have the time and just hang out in that country and travel. Yeah, I love it. I've been to so many places. I've been so lucky. I've been all over the place.
There was a there was a movie that actually I haven't seen of yours, which when I was doing my homework, I was like, oh, that looks really cool. I think it's called Wildlike.
Yeah, we shot that in Alaska.
Yeah, it looked
it's
amazing.
A beautiful little intimate little film with me and Ella Purnell, and it was, the vistas were incredible, very low budget. And really, you know, all of us just riding around in a van from location to location. Mm. And yeah, it's a nice little movie.
I love it when you see just the kind of the plot synopsis for that one captured my sort of imagination. And watching the trailer, obviously it being a lower budget film in comparison to some of the other things you've done, it's nice to see when a film is on location. Like, you can tell straight away that, you know, there's no green screen there. It's all real.
Yeah.
And that must be a real treat when you get to sort of go to all these places and shoot.
Oh yeah. I mean, I shot a movie called The Climb in Pakistan, it took us 3 days to climb to the first location.
Wow.
Yeah, literally. It was me, a cameraman and a guide and 20 porters. And it took 3 days to get up to the glacial field where we began to shoot.
Is that the film? Sorry, carry on.
Mm-mm. It was just fantastic. It was just
I was just going to say, is that the film that you broke your ankle on? Am I right in thinking?
Yeah.
How did that happen? Was that when you were shooting?
I was climbing. I was playing a climber, and we'd done a sequence of me climbing this face, and we were at about 15,000 feet and, but you know, only 20 feet to the ground, but at 15,000 feet. And I slipped, and we were coming down for lunch. I slipped and fell, and my leg curled up underneath me and popped. And we stayed up there for, I don't know, 3 or 4 more days. Didn't know it was broken. It was just very painful and swollen. And shot bits of me lying in the tent and looking up at the mountain and hobbling past the camera, and concealed it as much as we could. And then it started to turn yellow and green. So it took 2 days to piggyback me down to where our bus was parked, and then another day to drive to a military hospital where they taped it up. And then we couldn't get a flight out of Pakistan for another 10 days. So we went back into some villages and shot the opening sequence with my leg all taped up, which you can't see, of course. and then flew straight to, well, flew to Doha, to London, to Toronto, to Vancouver, and went straight into the hospital and had an operation.
Wow. And that was really early on in your career, wasn't it? It was right sort of.
Yeah, I was like 30.
Yeah. You would think, you'd probably think, God, this is a start. This is one way of doing it. Oh my God.
But you know what? It was fantastic. It was awesome. Mm. The mountains there and the people and, you know, and getting sick and going at both ends with a broken leg. It was just like, I'd do it all again.
So you were 30 when you did that film. So, I mean, that was, how old were you when you sort of had your first professional acting gig?
On stage, probably would have been when I was 20, maybe 20. Yeah, 20.
And then just sort of.
I did stage for like, I don't know, 6, 7 years or so. Then I moved to LA.
Mm-hmm. And you, I mean, LA is obviously the... it's the kind of land of opportunity. It's the place where all actors presume they need to go. And obviously it's a place where there's a lot of people trying to get into acting, but there's a lot of competition there. But has LA, I mean, you being in LA for a long time, has it changed a lot since you started out? I mean, it must be.
Well, it's changed in every way imaginable. The business has changed and the city has changed. And I mean, I remember when you walk into a room and you see 10 other guys, and my trick was that all the guys would look, you know, like they're all like, you know, a little better looking, a little, you know, a little more muscular and a little, you know, whatever, and a little younger and, you know, whatever your fears are about yourself. And I would say to myself, okay, there's 10 guys in the room. Five of them can't act. Two of them are going to blow it in the room. I'm working against 2.5 guys, and after that it's going to be, you know, flip a coin. So I'm really working against maybe one guy.
That's a great way to look at it. I'm going to do that next time I'm going.
That was my go-to was half of them can't act. And you'd never say to yourself, well, you're afraid that you also can't act, but I would never go there. Right?
No, don't go
that,
there.
That would, go I would there. Only go there. I would only go there when I didn't get it. Wow. You know,
it's that psychotic. Sorry.
Yeah. Gosh. Or I remember meeting Joel Schumacher was a Julia Roberts movie, I think, where she was playing somebody who had cancer. And there's a guy outside who in the waiting room who fit the description in the script literally as though the screenwriter had looked at this guy and described him, right? So I looked at the guy and I went, oh God. And it was the only other guy in the room in the waiting room. So I just went, oh God, what am I doing here? That's the guy. And I went into the room and I did the audition, but you know, and then I said to Joel, look, the guy you want is outside in the
Did window. You actually you said that?
I did. And Joel was offended and he goes, hey, don't tell me what I want. And I knew in that moment that not only had I lost the job, but I'd probably lost the opportunity to ever audition for him again. And the guy didn't get the part. I forget who it was.
Oh wow. So you psyched yourself out, but you were wrong.
I psyched myself out and then I talked the director out of using me.
Did you ever work with Joel Schumacher? I never know how to say his name.
No, I never met him in a room after that. It was all over.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
You've done all right, so it's fine. You obviously...
Yeah, no, that's fine. Who needs Joel?
And also, I've noticed that you've worked with a lot of people multiple times. So obviously, you create relationships and you go and do several films with multiple people, one being J.J. Abrams. Mm-hmm. Who you've worked with obviously on Star Trek, Super 8, which is one of my favorite films. I absolutely love that film. Creating relationships in the industry and you know, working with someone multiple times, it must be nice to go back and go, oh, you know, kind of, we don't have to do that kind of breaking the ice thing. I can just, you know, go straight into the thing and get on with it.
Yeah, it's a luxury to have a friendship already.
Films like Star Trek, huge, obviously, blockbuster movies, being part of something like that which has an already built-in, you know, everyone knows Star Trek, it's got a fan base, huge fan base. Mm-hmm. Are you a? I mean, you're either a Star Trek or a Star Wars guy. Are you? Which kind of? I guess you might have to say Star Trek, but do you
have having been neither really, I was more Star Trek because, you know, as a kid, I'd seen bits of the television series.
So, but
I was neither. I was really neither.
That's probably the best place to be.
Otherwise, the only interest I had in the Star Trek when I was a kid was, you know, seeing the women in the tight outfits. I didn't realize then that, you know, a lot of the themes were sort of classical themes and you know, I was completely lost on me.
Obviously working with people multiple times, obviously another person and to get to actually talk about your latest project, which is on Netflix. I mean, obviously you did Gerald's Game with Mike Flanagan, mm-hmm. and then had a little part in Haunting of Hill House, I believe, which mm-hmm. I personally, forgive me, don't remember, but apparently you're a ghost in that, in the background.
Ghost, I think it was ghost number 37.
Yep, amazing. I'm going to have to
find that. And there's also Dr. Sleep.
Dr. Sleep, of course, yep, which was absolutely brilliant. Like that, when that was coming out, I was thinking, oh, I don't know, do you want to touch this? I don't, like, do you want to go there? I feel like this.
Oh, Mike's fearless, man. He's an incredibly smart guy, and he's fearless. So
it's just incredible, though. That, I mean, particularly the end sequence in that film, not to give away to the audience that haven't seen it, but when they go back to the hotel, it's like, wow, nailed this. Like, it's so on point. But, you know, working with Mike and on these things and Gerald's Game was something that I hadn't heard anything about it, and when I watched it, I was just blown away. Such a simple concept and so well mm-hmm. executed. A lot of fun, and it must be unusual to get a part where, I don't want to again give away to the audience what happens, but it's kind of all in one room without giving too much away, and something happens to your character which isn't great early on. But doing a film like that, that's so all in one room and so compact, must be mm-hmm. exciting when the script's good enough to get away with that.
Well, and also the luxury is you can shoot in sequence.
Oh yeah, of course, yeah.
Right, which is a big deal.
Mm-mm.
And really pretty rare.
So once you were finished, you were done. The rest of the film had to be, you must have got done, and then they were still filming the rest of it, I'm guessing.
Well, all the stuff in the room was in sequence. I should say.
Oh, of course, because there's the
they didn't shoot the whole, we didn't shoot the whole thing in sequence in that sense, but because the exterior shots were all, you know, they were stacked up in a set of days, but all the stuff inside was in sequence. And Carla was fantastic. She's just one of those people who is only about solving whatever the problem is. She's so practical and enthusiastic and welcoming. And she came in really late. She came in late to Gerald's Game, like I came in late to Usher. There was somebody else had been cast and something happened before the shoot began. And she was dropped in like just a few days before we began.
Oh, wow.
And, yeah, you should interview her, actually, because
I'd love to.
There's a great story about how that happened.
Oh really? I'll have to. I'll reach out. Definitely.
In fact, it's probably I should tell that story, but we'll have to do it another time because it's a long shaggy dog. It's good.
Fair enough. Yeah, no, I'd love to hear it at some point. I mean that movie, and obviously The House of the Fall of Usher, which obviously she's in as well. That relationship and building that, and then going doing a full series where you are the lead in that, and it's what an incredible part.
It's time.
Your Honor, no matter how much evidence stacked against them, the Usher crime family stands stronger and darker than ever before.
Anyone comes after us, we will exhaust our arsenal until the threat's neutralized.
By neutralized, do you mean sued into oblivion on the streets?
Neutralized. Like dead.
You guys, we really should get together more often. It's just a balm for the soul.
Roderick Usher.
Your family is a collection of stunted hearts. Whose time has come?
Who are you?
Consequence. And tonight is consequential. I'm gonna head out. I've got an appointment with your dad.
Your brother's dead.
This is tragic, but a few "my heart will go on" tweets will pat it out.
This was no accident. You have been targeted. And this woman knows everything.
It's time, Roger. What did you do?
I'm afraid you're ringside for my reckoning, old friend.
I don't even own anything funeral black. Wait, that's not true. It's just fucking satin.
Satin is silk for poor people, and no one should wear it to a funeral unless they died in it.
Are we safe?
If we don't stop her, you won't have a family left.
Frankly, I think you've forgotten what I am.
Nevermore. 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 Nevermore.
The House of Usher. May it rest in peace.
When I was watching it, I was thinking, this is like, you've got all these big monologues and it's all on you, like those moments in the house. And how obviously you say you came on late to that when you were sent the script.
Luxury, 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 because the monologues are so fun.
Yeah, right? Yeah.
And I came in late. So it was, it was a lot of cramming to try and get them, get them on my tongue, Mm. But just the language is just so fun.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry, I interrupt you. What was your question going
to
be?
No. I was just saying it must be incredible to have a part like that. And, over the years you've had all these parts in different things, but this really feels like, You can't get a part much meatier than that. It's like,
it's oh, you can't.
It's a great part. It's a great
like,
part.
Yeah, he called me up and I was working on a television show and then it was just, we were just about to go on hiatus and he called me up like on a Wednesday or I guess it was Wednesday. And he goes, hey, look it. I'd love you to, first I was at dinner with my wife and he texted me, he goes, can you talk? And I had just sent him a script for something that I was developing.
Hmm.
And asked him to read it. And like a couple weeks before, and I went, oh, man, maybe he's read it. Cool. Yeah, I can talk. Sure. I'll leave dinner. Absolutely. Get my wife to order another glass of wine. And I stepped outside and he goes, hey, would you like to come and do Usher? And I went, when? And he goes, Monday.
Wow.
And I go, well, how long is it, Mike? And he goes, it's like 550 pages. And I go, well, when would I have to decide? And he goes, we need to know tomorrow.
Wow.
And I go, okay, send me everything and I'll read as much as I can. And I went back and told Susan and she just went, this is a big deal.
Yeah.
Well, read what you can overnight and then take the plunge if it speaks to you, and as soon as I started reading I went, oh my god, this is way bigger than I am prepared to go for, but it's so good that okay. And I called him back and said, yeah, I'm there. And we finished shooting in Atlanta on the television series on a Saturday night. And on Sunday morning, I flew to Vancouver, went into makeup. I brought a mustache with me and they glued that on for the test. And then 5 o'clock that morning, the next morning, boom, we were doing it.
Wow, that's madness.
Yeah.
I think this leads me on to a question of for me personally, almost, because I'm dyslexic, so I struggle with learning lines in a short period of time. So what you've just described there is a nightmare. How, no matter how good the role is,
it was.
Yeah. How, what's your? Do you have a system to learn lines? Do you have a kind of go to?
Yeah, I read it through a couple of times. You know, once I've read the whole script and I kind of understand what where it's all going, then I'll, if I work on particular scenes, I'll read it through a couple of times. Just read. And then I'll start to speak it out loud. And then I'll just repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, repeat it, repeat it. Well, check. Sometimes I'll print it out and walk around the house and try and do it without looking, and then, you know, sneak a peek at the page. And then my wife, Susan, will, you know, she goes, you know, are you ready? And I'll go, I think I might be. I think I might be. She goes, okay. And then she'll be on book and do the other lines. And then I'll try doing it with an activity, right? Like if we're washing the dishes, like I'll do, like get her to be on book and I'll do, you know, some motor activity.
Yeah. Clever.
Right. That helps me. That just, it seems to, once it's kind of seated, you know, you have to let your body start working. Right. I do anyway.
So it's the words to motion, isn't it?
I'll try and have a task, you know, and not repeat the task, right? Because so often when once you're on the set, you know, you link bits of dialogue and beats to things that you're doing.
Right.
So I try not to if I don't like load the dishwasher again and go, oh, I have to. You know, I have to say downtown when I put the tray in the dishwasher, you know. But it's just repetition. It's just repetition. Read, read, read. But with dyslexia, you have trouble reading also, right?
Yeah, it makes things quite difficult.
Well, do you do it audio wise? Do you have somebody read it out and just learn it orally?
Yeah, usually I record my lines and then I'll get my partner to record the other lines and then I'll listen to it while I'm sleeping and listen to it when I'm walking around the house and try and get it in there enough so then I can actually read it fluently without it kind of stuttering.
Okay. Yeah. So you kind of do it backwards the way I do it.
Yeah. Well, then I'll kind of start to do things like you were describing there. And maybe I shouldn't say this because it's probably not dangerous, but I find I learn lines easiest when I'm driving the car. So if I put it on the radio, if I listen to lines while I'm driving, then actually because I'm thinking about driving. So as long as I know the lines a little bit, that kind of speeds up the process, I find. So doesn't it's similar to washing the dishes.
Yeah, but doesn't that interfere with your choice of operative words? And
just to get it in my head roughly, just to kind of the early stages of learning it. But when once I kind of know it a bit, then I do like to do it. I like to learn it as flat as possible.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
I'm open to play with it when I'm on set.
Right.
But I still feel like I haven't found the best way. There must be a better way of doing it, because it's always painful. It's always pretty horrendous.
I have a couple of friends who have trouble memorizing stuff, and for various reasons. And I don't know that they've ever come up with. You're fucked, basically.
It's made a lot. I know so many actors that can just. Photographic memory, you can literally read it once or twice and know it, and I just think, how is that fair? That's so unfair.
I'm not one of those guys.
I think sometimes that I'll personally have a better performance because if I could learn the lines really quickly, or if I've only got a few lines, I haven't had to look at it, read it, think about it, do it hundreds of times. And I'm not completely, I haven't forgotten about it almost. If I've only got a few lines, I think maybe that's the thing. If I have to put so much effort in that by the time I'm on set and I know it backwards, I'm not worried of thinking about any of that. I'm just on the character. So it kind of, I feel like it actually helps me in a way.
Well, I only have one friend who believes in barely memorizing and he's very good, but everybody I know, and me particularly, I'm the better I know it, the better I am.
Oh yeah, preparation.
Yeah, and it's not preparation in terms of deciding beats necessarily, because I discovered on Usher that, because I was so unprepared in terms of really deep diving into the material over a period of time, I was just learning stuff every day and trying to get it memorized. So a lot of the choices, acting choices I was making during the process were, you know, sort of extempore, right? They were just like off the, they're in the moment, and you know, that's just the way that landed that take, because that's how I was retrieving it from my mushy brain, you know. And maybe there's value there, right? I sort of began to think after it came out, I go, oh well, maybe I should concentrate less on tiny little moments and beats and plan stuff less. I saw a great interview with Julianne Moore the other day where she was saying, I want to be prepared, but I also want to leave room for something to happen, something real to happen on camera that I don't expect. Right.
Definitely.
And,
yeah.
And there was a lot of stuff in Usher that I didn't expect, because I just didn't have the time to make a plan.
It was, and I'm not just saying this because you're on the podcast, but genuinely watching it, I was like, this is like a masterclass. Like, the performance was incredible.
Oh, thanks, man.
When life hands you lemons,
make lemonade.
No. First, you roll out a multimedia campaign to convince people lemons are incredibly scarce, which only works if you stockpile lemons, control the supply, then a media blitz. Lemons are the only way to say I love you, the must-have accessory for engagements or anniversaries. Roses are out, lemons are in, billboards that say she won't have sex with you unless you've got lemons. You cut De Beers in on it. Limited edition lemon bracelets, yellow diamonds called lemon drops. You get Apple to call their new operating system OS Lemon. Little accent over the O. You charge 40% more for organic lemons, 50% more for conflict-free lemons. You pack the Capitol with lemon lobbyists. You get a Kardashian to suck a lemon wedge in a leaked sex tape. Timothy Chalamet wears lemon shoes at Cannes. Get a hashtag campaign. Something isn't cool or tight or awesome. No, it's lemon. Did you see that movie? Did you go to that concert? It was effing lemon. Billie Eilish, OMG, hashtag lemon. You get Dr. Oz to recommend 4 lemons a day and a lemon suppository supplement to get rid of toxins, because there's nothing scarier than toxins. Then you patent the seeds. You write a line of genetic code that makes lemons look just a little more like tits, and you get a gene patent for the tit lemon DNA sequence. You cross-pollinate, you get those seeds circulating in the wild, and then you sue the farmers for copyright infringement when that genetic code shows up on their land. Sit back, rake in the millions, and then when you're done, and you've sold your lempire for a few billion dollars, then, and only then, you make some fucking lemonade.
When we were watching it, actually, it's funny. I got to the end of it and I was like, you know, he would make a really great Batman. And then I realized when I did all my homework on this, I was like, all right, okay, it's already happened. He's already done it. He's voiced Batman many times. But yeah, that was something I didn't know about you. And then it made perfect sense once I looked at a couple of clips. I was like, yeah, of course.
Who are you working for? You
gotta drop down there a little bit. You gotta let the chest voice talk. It's hard to get volume sometimes, but
so good.
Most embarrassing moments, yeah.
You did say you had a funny story, an embarrassing moment maybe that you're willing to share.
I never told the story before, because I sat there for a few minutes thinking. Yeah, it's an exclusive. I was doing a television show called Nowhere Man. Dean Stockwell was a guest star, and there was a beautiful monologue that I got to give, and I was really, it's when you're doing a television series, you're just cranking it out, right? And every now and then, there, you know, some scripts are better than others, and some scripts are like, oh, this is one of the good ones of this season, you know, and that was one of those. And I had a beautiful monologue, but it required me to be drunk, to play drunk, right? So, you know what's coming.
Yeah, I feel like right? I do.
So it was, 11 o'clock at night, and we sort of ran through, got behind, ran through the scene, and we just started to shoot, and then we had to break for lunch, and I had had a shot, maybe a shot and a half of vodka. And it was, and I, you know how you have one drink, maybe two drinks, you're just aware of your lips being a little fat, or, you know, you're just you're not inebriated, right? You're completely in control, but you can feel that you've had something to drink, right? And I thought, yeah, that's about the right level. Yeah, that's about the right level. And the monologue was going okay. And we're just kind of roughing it in. We got the wide shot. And then we had lunch. And I was straight sober. Like by 10 minutes into lunch, I was like sober. And I thought, okay, well, I'll have another. It was an hour long lunch, middle of the night. I'm just sharp sober, right? And so aware of how sober I am that I was even more sober than I'm when I'm sober. So I had another shot. I felt nothing. Nothing. And, 10 minutes go by and, fuck. I had so much pasta that I'm never going to feel it. I could drink this fifth and I wouldn't feel it. So I had a bunch more to drink.
Oh, no.
And we got back to the set and I was still, and I had this fake scar, this fake bloody scar in my head. And I was still like pretty sober. And then the camera started rolling and I literally, it was like seeing a train going, wow, bam. And I was like, I'm sorry. I was hammered and tried to do the monologue and I literally couldn't, and it was such a good monologue, right? And I was so excited about doing it and I wanted so badly to do a good job.
I'm telling you guys, she was just standing there looking at me, just and the rain was just coming down in buckets, and she just stood there and stared at me like she'd never even seen me before. And there wasn't even a hint of recognition in her eyes. I don't know. I don't know, man. I think that probably hurts more than anything else that's happened.
And I was just hammered. And I wiped the scar off. They'd have to come in and put it back on. So I literally spent the whole monologue doing it a line at a time, forgetting what the next line was. Like, I'm sorry. What's the... Okay. And I do the next line. So the monologue was non-existent. This beautiful monologue that I was then hammered out of my mind and apologetic and embarrassed and humiliated. And then Dean Stockwell, the poor guy, is just going, what the fuck is happening with this actor? What an idiot. But he was very nice about it. And I said, when I'd done my coverage, I'll be here for you off camera. He goes, go home. go home. You know, you've done enough. You've done plenty, right?
Oh, so, that's so good. That's yeah, so good.
So, you know, word to the wise, you know, learn how to play drunk. Don't get any medicinal help.
Did that make it in, that monologue?
It had to, yeah.
It's
in there.
I have to find a clip of this.
Well, I think they probably play it mostly on Dean Stockwell. Because I'm unwatchable.
Bruce, yeah. Thank you so much. This is really inspiring, man. Thank you for taking the time.
Yeah, sure. Happy to.
Thanks, man.
And good luck to you. Maybe we'll get a chance to, you know, have a scene.
Well, that would be great. One day I have my fingers crossed.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you. All right, take cheers. Care, man.
Take care.
All the best.
To you too.
Bye. Here's the Laugh and Feel motherfucker. Subscribe and like and follow.
Thank you to our guest, Bruce. And thank you to Gene at Beechwood Entertainment Collective for organising this. As always, thank you to our sponsor, BetterHelp.